Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Last week, after years of negotiations, water officials from 7 Western states reached an agreement to voluntarily reduce their water use. The agreement is part of a plan to manage the Colorado River after 19 years of droughts. The 1,450-mile-long river starts in the central Rocky Mountains of Colorado and includes parts of 7 states: Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, and California. For 17 miles, the river forms the international boundary between Arizona and Mexico. In his recent 5-part series headlined "The West Great River Hits Its Limits, Will the Colorado Run Dry?" today's guest, veteran journalist Jim Robbins, details how this mighty river, which serves 40 million people, could go dry because of climate change and years of drought. He writes, quote, "There are large existential questions facing the 40 million people who depend on the river. There simply is not enough water for all who depend on it, and there will likely soon be even less," end quote. So how has climate change impacted the Colorado River Basin? What does this mean for the ecosystem and the tens of millions of people who depend on it? Jim Robbins is a veteran environmental journalist based in Helena, Montana. He writes about the loss of biodiversity and climate change for the New York Times and other national and international publications. This 5-part series called Crisis on the Colorado, he wrote for Yale Environment 360. Jim Robbins' latest book is The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. We had Jim on to talk about that. You can search for that show at yourcallradio.org. And Jim Robbins joins us from Helena, Montana. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. What a very important project you took on. Before we dive into your piece, I want to ask you about your thoughts on the announcement that we just got from water officials from 7 Western states. They finally reached consensus on how to cut water usage before the federal government moves in and does it for them. Jim, how significant is this deal?
Well, it's very significant. It's been a long time coming, and it's been a difficult path to get there, because people are reluctant, of course, to give up water. But it will buy time, essentially. It really will buy time, perhaps, until they can figure out other solutions. It keeps water in Lake Mead is what it does. By foregoing the use of water for agriculture and for cities, it keeps water in Lake Mead and keeps the government from declaring a federal emergency and taking actions on its own to reduce water use in the lower basin, which is Arizona, Nevada, and California.
So what does this mean for these states? What changes will people have to make?
Well, agriculture has to give up a bunch of water. The city of Phoenix and other water users have to give up water, and it's hoped that it will be thought out and have a long time to do this, rather than having these solutions imposed on them by the federal government. So that's what's behind it. It might save the day for a while, but it also could be a drop in the bucket if the climate future of the West is what some people think, which is not just a drought, but a long-term aridification of the Southwest, which would be permanent and could be continuing to be a permanent drought, essentially. Now, I have to say that this year has been a remarkable year for snow in the Colorado Rockies, as it's been for snow in California. Because of El Nino, there's more snow than there has been in the last 20 years in the Colorado Rockies, but that's 1 year, and no one is sure what's going to happen. So that's why this is still taking place.
So these 7 states include, it's Arizona, California, Nevada, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and Wyoming. And, you know, as you said, Jim, there were so many stories about droughts in California. They still exist if you really look for them. But over the last couple of weeks, you know, we've been getting so much rain in California. And the headlines we saw, it's, look, this is great. After 10 years, California is no longer facing a drought. Can you put that in perspective for us? I mean, what does that really say to Californians?
Well, I don't know about California, but I do know about the Colorado River because snow, first off, snow is really important rather than rain. And I think it's the same for California. And snow is important because it's a slow release. Snow sits up in the mountains, hopefully until May or June, maybe even longer. And it slowly releases into the river. It's almost like a natural reservoir. If it rains, of course, it pulses through the system very quickly. And so that's a whole different kettle of fish, because if they don't have long-term storage, which the upper Colorado doesn't have, then that water goes through the system very quickly and isn't stored. Snow, on the other hand, is long-term, so that's a good thing. And the snow levels have been dropping over the last 20 years. The drought that has occurred on the Colorado River, according to tree ring studies, and I've been to the tree ring lab and looked in depth at this issue, is the longest drought since medieval times in the Colorado River. So that puts it in perspective. Now, whether it ends this year and then we have regular snow years or average snow years or above average from here out, it remains to be seen. But a lot of people who have studied this issue think that climate change is causing, again, a permanent drought of sorts on the Colorado River, and that would be very difficult for the people who live along there. And the answer to that is no one really knows, and so they have to prepare for the worst case scenario, which is what they're doing along the Colorado.
So we'll talk about climate change in a minute, but more generally about the Colorado River. As you report, it travels 1,450 miles from the Rocky Mountains to the Gulf of California, provides water to about 40 million people, irrigating nearly 6 million acres of farmland, and passes through 9 national parks. We've done a lot of shows, Jim, just about where our water comes from and how these systems work. The Colorado River is so incredibly important. I mean, to ecosystems, which we'll talk about, and providing water to 40 million people. Can you lay this out for us? I mean, what is the most important, you know, thing we need to know here just about how the Colorado River supplies so much water to so many people?
Well, first, let me say that I traveled the full length of the Colorado. I went to Rocky Mountain National Park, where the river begins, and you can jump across it, which I did and got my shoes wet, but it's not that much of a leap. And I went all the way down to where the Colorado empties into the Gulf of California in Mexico. And it's fascinating. I mean, absolutely gorgeous river. It begins in Colorado. Colorado is called the mother of rivers because it also is the birthplace of the Rio Grande and the South Platte and other rivers. And that snow is you know, life-bringing to much of the West. And so we followed it along. And I guess the single biggest impression of the Colorado River is just how engineered it is. There are natural sections and natural places, but really those places exist with the permission of the engineers who have built dams, hundreds of dams all along the river, two main ones, of course, the Hoover Dam, and which is where Lake Mead is, and then Lake Powell, which is in the dam at Page, Arizona. And so it's controlled all along. And where nature does exist, it is allowed to exist because it is so controlled. And so that people call it the most engineered waterway in the world.
Can you elaborate on this? As you write, it's become a network of expensive dams, reservoirs, pipelines, canals, flumes, and aqueducts. How have all of these projects, even say without climate change, and then we'll go there, how have all those projects impacted the river and the river's ecology?
Well, for 15 miles below the two big dams, it is a cold water fishery. You know, the Colorado River evolved as a warm water fishery, and it had these it's called a flashy river. That means that there are times of huge water flows, hundreds of thousands of acre feet just roaring down out of the mountains and into the Gulf of Mexico. And then there are times when the river would slow to a virtual trickle for the Colorado. And so a lot of the fisheries along the river, and there's five or six species of fish that are endemic to the Colorado River that exist nowhere else. So they evolve with these conditions. Bony-tailed chub is one of them. A pike minnow is another. And so when you change that ecological dynamic, you wipe out a lot of species out. I don't think there are any that have disappeared, but there are some that have disappeared in the lower Colorado. And so the managers have been trying to bring them back. But it's a challenge because below the dams, 15 to 20 miles of cold water is no longer suitable for these fish. And there are other places where habitat has been destroyed. So that's one aspect of it. On the lower end of the Colorado in Mexico, it's been totally wiped out. We've turned a river into a river of sand and trees. Salt cedar is the tree that grows there. And we flew over it, and you can just look down and see virtually no water at all. In fact, I went to the dam, the Morelos Dam, just south of Yuma, where the last of the water is diverted for farms along the border in Mexico. And it is less than a trickle. I mean, it's really no wider than my hand, where it comes out below the irrigation ditch where it's diverted, and then it eventually dries up a mile or so later. And it's completely sand until you reach a part of that lower basin where some restoration has taken place with runoff from agricultural fields.
And speaking of changes, Jim, you report that even in rock-ribbed conservative areas, those who use the water of the Colorado say that they are seeing things they've never seen before. This year, state officials in Colorado cut off lower-priority irrigators of the Yampa River, and recreation had to be halted, for example, and have grudgingly come to believe there is something going on with the climate.
That's right. These are unheard of things, and people are very nervous. They are nervous about climate. They are nervous about a lack of water. They are nervous about cities coming to take water from them because they don't, in rural areas, they don't have the political power to fight off the cities. And if someone told me, if the minute someone in one of the casinos in Las Vegas turns on his tap and no water comes out, the whole dynamic will change. Agriculture uses 80% of the water along the Colorado. They get very inexpensive water, and they get lots of it, and they're concerned that they're the ones who have a target on their back.
This is just a massive number. Agriculture, as you said, uses 80% of Colorado's flow to irrigate 6 million acres of crops, the largest share of which is alfalfa grown to feed cattle, whereas cities use just 10%. Can you talk more about that? Again, agriculture uses 80%, cities use 10%.
Right. It was one of the surprises to me when I started this series was, everyone thinks, geez, you know, Phoenix, Las Vegas, they're using all this water, Los Angeles. I mean, and they are. They're using water. But those cities especially have done a very good job of what they say is decoupling growth from water, that they are saving so much water by eliminating lawns, especially by using water-saving devices and so on, that they have grown without – they've added homes without having to have an increase in water. And that's remarkable if you think about it. Everyone thinks of Phoenix as this unsustainable city in the desert, and perhaps in some ways it is, but it's different than we perhaps think of it. Now, there are areas outside of Phoenix, you know, suburban Phoenix and other places that are still using water in large amounts. But Phoenix itself, the city, has done a great job in reducing its demand from homeowners, and has Las Vegas. They have. I read a piece. I didn't go to Las Vegas, but I did read about how they have water police essentially looking for leaks in pipelines and things to make sure that water isn't wasted. So a lot of the water is used to grow alfalfa, which is fed to cattle to grow beef. That's the biggest, I think 30% of that 80%, a third of that 80% is used for that reason. And it's an inefficient way of raising alfalfa. It's flooding the field with several inches of water every once in a while to grow. And there are people working on ways to save water along the Colorado, in the farm and ranch country of the Colorado, so that water can be put back into the stream. And they're doing things like replacing alfalfa with pecans, where you can water just around each tree. You can make more money, and you can also target your water to be used with a little microjet around each of the trees, so you use a lot less water. And there are strategies like this all along the Colorado River. The Nature Conservancy is heading up a lot of this effort. And I was really impressed with a lot of the things that are going on. And their concern is not only to keep water in the Colorado River for use in cities and by people and so on, but also for nature. That's a big part of them, for the fish that live there, for the wildlife. 90% of wildlife and biodiversity live within a mile of the rivers in the Southwest. And that's a big deal. So this water is really important to other life forms besides our own.
Today we're joined by veteran environmental journalist Jim Robbins, and he has a five-part series on the Colorado River in Yale Environment 360, and I hope you can take the time to read this important piece of journalism. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Jim writes about the loss of biodiversity and climate change for many publications, including the New York Times. If you have any questions or comments about this very important issue, again, we're talking about the Colorado River serving 40 million people, but it could go dry because of climate change and 19 years of drought. So if you have any questions or comments for Jim, we'd love to hear from you. Last week, after years of negotiations, officials from 7 Western states reached an agreement to voluntarily reduce water used from the Colorado River because of these issues. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. It's really important to follow the water to find out where it goes and what it's being used for, and to also talk about how climate change is affecting this. So if you have any questions about these issues, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So, Jim, we were talking about agriculture. Again, as you report, it uses 80% of Colorado's flow compared to cities using 10%. And you brought up alfalfa. Do we know how much of the agricultural acreage is owned by big and powerful agriculture companies?
There is a lot of that in the lower Colorado River Basin. Not so much. It's very different in the upper basin. So there are a lot of big companies that own farms, say, in the Imperial Irrigation District. I don't know what the breakout is, but I do know I've talked with several small farmers, say, Palisades, Colorado. They grow a lot of peaches and other fruit there, famous for their peaches, as a matter of fact. They grow alfalfa and other things. And I think there's thousands of farmers in that one irrigation district who have small 100 to 200 acre farms. So it's a mix of those things. So water, if it starts to go missing, will affect a lot of family farms and farm communities as well as large companies. I just saw a piece today that I tweeted on my feed about, it was in The Guardian, and it's about how Saudi Arabia has bought up a lot of acreage in the Colorado River drainage to grow alfalfa, to ship over to Saudi Arabia to feed its dairy cows there. So and water has historically been very cheap on the Colorado, and that's a big part of the formula here. One of the things I learned in Colorado, amongst other places, is that water has been, that was claimed a long time ago, what are called senior water rights, are delivered virtually free except for delivery costs. And so if you start to see water becoming much more valuable, people will start to, investors and cities and other users who have money will start to buy out the water from small farming communities. And it's happened before, and it's happened especially on the Arkansas River. I reported years ago on the Arkansas, a place called Crowley County, and it's called By and Dry. And the city of Arvada, Colorado, came in and bought out a bunch of farms. They dried them up. They're weeds now. And they used to grow these famous melons that they were known for around the West. And that's now just, you could, if you look on Google Earth, it's all just dry land and weeds. And that water now goes to the Front Range. And so there's concern that as water becomes very valuable, a lot of these farmers and ranchers are going to sell out to companies, to investors, and these communities are going to dry up and blow away. And then we have a track record of that kind of thing in the West. Now, I would have to say, when I wrote the piece years ago about Crowley County, that was standard operating procedure. Now people are very much more conscious of doing that, and there's a great effort being taken to avoid derailing some of these farm communities and taking away their water. But it's still a possibility.
Well, what are your thoughts on the globalization of food? Because I believe it was in 2016, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting had a large story about alfalfa and the Saudis, the alfalfa being sold to the Saudis. CNBC had a piece called Saudi Arabia is Buying Up Farmland in the U.S. Southwest. They also say, according to the CNBC, that China, South Korea, and Japan are big buyers of American hay. And then you pointed out this piece that a listener just sent us in The Guardian out today, Who Keeps Buying California's Scarce Water, Saudi Arabia. Based on the people that you interviewed, Jim, what do they think about this, and what, if anything, should be done about it?
Well, it's a little bit out of the purview of the story, but I would say that it's only made possible by cheap water and cheap fossil fuels. You can't fly hay if it's expensive to grow with expensive water. You can't fly hay to Saudi Arabia economically. So that's actually one of the arguments for giving, and there are people who really believe that this water should be marketed, that it should go to the highest bidder. And when you start to do that, people save water, and things like the subsidized water, which it is, a lot of this water is subsidized by the federal government, is a thing that allows this international trade in alfalfa, such things as alfalfa, to go on.
Well, thank you for sending over that article, Patricia. Greg writes in, can you talk about the Cadillac Desert? You mentioned that in your piece, Jim.
Right. Mark Reisner wrote that years ago, I think in the 70s, and it's a famous book. And he was the first one to call this hugely expensive infrastructure a Cadillac Desert, you know, the dams and canals and other things. And it's only made possible by the largesse of federal taxpayers who have contributed to these systems. I mean, a lot of these farms couldn't make money if it weren't for this heavily subsidized water infrastructure. And that's what he's getting at. And you know, I have to say, I've been doing this for 40 years covering the West, and a lot of the West's economy is based on federal subsidies, whether it's grazing or mining or logging. And without the federal government paying the bills, a lot of those things would have gone away a long time ago.
Today we're speaking with veteran environmental journalist Jim Robbins about his five-part series on the Colorado River, which serves 40 million people. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions for Jim, we'd love to hear from you. Also, how are you conserving water? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment at the show's website, set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Mulling over the Mueller report on 1A in 1/2 hour here on 91.7.
This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're speaking with Jim Robbins, a veteran environmental journalist based in Helena, Montana. Jim traveled the full length of the Colorado River for his five-part series on the river, which serves 40 million people, and I hope you can take the time to read it. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. Jim writes that as the Southwest faces rapid growth and unrelenting drought, the Colorado River is in crisis with too many demands on its diminishing flow. So if you have any questions for Jim about the river, this is such an important issue. We'd also love to hear from you about conserving. Now that there's so much information out about how much water is used for agriculture, have you decided to change your diet? What are your thoughts about how your government talks about these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So, Jim, you spoke to so many people for your piece. Can you talk about how climate change is contributing to the Colorado River's depleting water supply? What are we learning about that?
Well, one of the big things is that the Lake Mead and Lake Powell are both very large. Lake Mead is 120 miles long. And there's huge amounts of evaporation that take place out of these lakes. I think that the evaporation out of Lake Mead is greater than the amount of water that Las Vegas uses. So it's a huge part of the equation. And then there's less snow. That's the big one. There's less snow because of change in the jet stream and climate, other climate changes. Snow is coming or is melting earlier, and so there's no water later in the season. Some of it's rain, which again doesn't have a long-term release. It melts quickly and pulses, it falls quickly and pulses through the system. And then there's a lot of dust from construction and human activity in the Southwest, and that dust is falling on the snow in Colorado and causing it to melt sooner. And so that's another problem. And when you have when the snow melts quicker, sooner in the year, you have the ground exposed longer and it heats up and there's more melting. So it's kind of a loop and there's more evaporation. So it's a multitude of things that are happening to the Colorado. And one of the things that's driving it into crisis. And I have to say, this is an important point. The Colorado River is kind of an extreme example of this, but it's happening. This is what's happening all over the world, is that these systems that we've, ecosystems that we've stressed because of human use, by logging or by using water or cutting replacing native prairie with farms and so on. Those things stress the natural systems. And there's a model being born on the Colorado, and that is how do we, you can end climate change or mitigate climate change, which we're not doing a very good job of, or you can make the system more resilient. And that's what's going on in the Colorado. I'm very impressed with what people are doing all along the Colorado River by cutting down on the water they use, by installing new head gates or installing new kinds of irrigation or installing new sprinklers that use a lot less water than flood irrigation. And on the San Pedro River in Arizona, which is a tributary eventually to the Colorado, their Nature Conservancy is working on a project to use runoff from Sierra Vista that would fall in the streets of downtown Sierra Vista and using it to recharge groundwater that feeds the San Pedro River, which is really critical to biodiversity there. They have something like 420 bird species that use it, which is a lot, and 83 mammal species and so on. So I have to shout out to the Nature Conservancy, especially how they're working with local groups along a lot of these tributaries to the Colorado to restore nature, which also has the effect of allowing more water to flow into the system and enhance resilience. And that's a model that can be used all over the world on a lot of these rivers that are being taken to the limit in terms of what they can provide.
So speaking of action, Jim, are you seeing a lot of movement at the state and local levels? So, for example, Nevada, Arizona, are these politicians taking these issues seriously?
Some of them are. Some of them are taking them very seriously, and some of them aren't. I mean, Arizona is notoriously behind the curve on some of this stuff. But local politicians like Catherine Sorensen in Phoenix, she stepped up. I mean, they have really reduced the water use in Phoenix through some enlightened management there. And they found alternative sources. They think at some point, perhaps in the next 4 or 5 years, depending on the climate, that Lake Mead could go to Deadpool. And Deadpool is when the lake drops far enough that water can no longer be piped out. And in fact, Las Vegas just put a new pipe in, a third straw, they call it, at the very bottom of Lake Mead, so that even if the lake drops to that level, they can still get drinking water. I mean, it's that desperate. I mean, people are really worried that this change in the climate could leave them high and dry. But she has done things that are not just her, but she's kind of headed up the Phoenix Water Department, looking at these things like building new infrastructure to use water from other places and recharging aquifers that have been depleted by using Colorado River water that's available now and piping it into these underground storage areas. And so there is enlightened management. And that's helping. And then there, on some levels, there's just, Pinal County, where the farmers there grow cotton, they just want to keep using Colorado River water, and it's been very controversial, and they really balked at trying to give up the water, although in the end they did. And then there's the Salton Sea in California, which is another big part of this. The Salton Sea, the Imperial Irrigation District, the largest water user on the Colorado, wanted $200 million from the federal government to improve the ecology of the Salton Sea, which is widely used by hundreds of bird species and is a health threat because it's drying up and the dust is causing respiratory problems. It didn't become part of the drought contingency plan because it didn't get a guarantee from the government. So there are some places that are pitching in and trying to solve these problems and some that are dragging their feet.
And to spend a little more time on Lake Mead, which is a major supplier of water, as you said, to Las Vegas, Arizona, and Southern California, Its water level has dropped by more than 40%, and you write that if water levels continue to drop, sinking below 1,050 feet, Hoover Dam, which impounds Lake Mead and provides power to millions of people in Southern California, Nevada, and Arizona, will stop generating electricity because water levels will be too low to flow through it?
That's a distinct possibility. That's definitely something that's on many people's minds. Many people, 10 years ago, no one thought it would go this far, but it's gone very rapidly downhill. That's why people are nervous about all this. And now I have to say, I think I read this morning that the snow this year is 130 or 140% of average. So it's going to buy some time. Apparently. Now, one of the things that's happening with climate change is that in a good year, this might have saved the day. But now with things melting earlier and it's getting hotter and melting faster, we all know what's happening with temperatures. It could not be the boom that we think it is. It might pulse through the system a lot faster, and it won't buy us time, or won't buy the Colorado River states time as it might have in the past when temperatures were cooler and the water was released over a much longer period of time.
And Jonathan Overpeck, a climate scientist at the University of Michigan, said, quote, "We've seen declines in flow of 20%, but it could get up to 50% or worse later in this century."
Yeah, if it goes to that, then all hope is lost for a lot of the things we've come to take for granted, such as Palisade peaches and vegetables from America's salad bowl down in the Imperial Irrigation District and in Mexico. Mexico grows a huge amount of vegetables and other things, and right over the border near Yuma. And it's all bets are off at that point if it goes to 50%. And it could happen. Look what happened. The Rio Grande last year went dry in June. And wow. It's an alarming time. This is real. And again, to stress this may not just be a drought. This may be a permanent long-term drying of the Southwest. And if that's true, and we won't know until, you know, it happens over the next 10, 20, 30 years, and then all bets are really off.
And then what?
Well, and then we adapt, and then people start leaving. I mean, I did mention in one of the pieces that we could see climate refugees leaving the Colorado River Basin and moving to the Great Lakes or places where there's more water, and they could still, you know, farm or ranch or, you know, live with water availability. I mean, that's just that will drive an out migration.
Today we're speaking with Jim Robbins, a veteran environmental journalist based in Helena, Montana. He traveled the full length of the Colorado River to write a 5-part series on what is happening to that river. It serves 40 million people, but as Jim is saying, it could go dry because of climate change and 19 years of drought. You can find the stories at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions or comments for Jim, we'd love to hear from you. You know, this is one of the reasons, Jim, why after the election, every Monday we decided to focus on these issues, because we knew that so much of the media space was going to be focused on Trump and tweets. And that's exactly what has happened. And so, you know, to be able to spend an hour with you on this issue is just so incredibly important.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. I like doing it, and that helps. And I, you know, I have a big picture view of things. That's one of the things that this job allows me to do, is to do a lot of different stories on a lot of different places on the ecosystems. Ecosystems are what maintain us. And we couldn't live without them, as we're finding on the Colorado River. And I have to say, I've been doing this for 40 years, and I see people paying attention to the world as never before, the natural world. And I think that's critical. And it's been driven by emergency, but that's a good thing to come out of this. You know, I've heard a saying that I'm an intellectual pessimist, but a glandular optimist. And this, what I see going on in a lot of places, is optimistic to me. And yes, there's a lot to worry about, but but there's also a lot to be encouraged by.
And, well, you wrote an entire book about the wonder of birds, which I think says a lot. I mean, it's so important to write about these issues. You know, speaking of the ecosystem, Jim, earlier you talked about how there are five or six species of fish that are endemic to the Colorado River. What else did you learn about the ecosystem and, you know, the creatures that live and rely on this river?
That in the arid Southwest, it's really hot, but this Colorado River and its tributaries are essential to a very unusual array of biodiversity because it's so warm and the species there thrive. The water is really what makes them able to inhabit it. In other words, it'd be, you know, like the Atacama Desert, which doesn't have a lot of life at all. But with the water, it's this coming together of two elements that make this a really incredible place. Now, a lot of these rivers and streams have been damaged, and so a lot of biodiversity has diminished. But it's still there, and it will still come back. That's one of the things I'm impressed with, is these things will come back if you treat these places in a way that kind of honors other species besides humans and restores a lot of these things to the river. Now, one of the things I try to do in my writing, and I tried to do this with the bird book and the tree book I wrote before that called The Man Who Planted Trees, is that we have lost our wonder of the world. I mean, it's incredible. And when you start to look deeply into these subjects, you realize, one, how little we know about them. Trees, you look out the window, well, there's a tree out there and it's a stick with leaves, but it's far much more than that. I mean, there is evidence that trees are somehow connected to the stars. There's evidence that trees can clean, that they do clean our water. Forests, you know, with waterfalls and goes through the roots of trees, it cleans our water so robustly that trees are used to clean up toxic waste site, and on and on and on. I could go on, and we just have scratched the surface. We're living in this deep mystery, the whole world. And my job is to kind of point out what we know, the very little we do know, and also the huge amounts of things that we don't know, but we have a sense of, perhaps. And then things, well, I can't do anything about the things we don't know at all, but I would like wave my hands and say they're likely out there.
Hmm. Well, we have an email. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that's the story of the Colorado. There was this amazing world here before the Europeans came with their farms and ranches, mm-hmm. and their use of the water, and which of course was the mindset at the time. I don't blame people for that, but now we're starting to recognize just how incredible it was. The other part of this that I would mention is that we have a lesson as to what could happen. It's a very different time, but you know, the Hohokam once lived, Indian people, Native people in Arizona once lived right where Phoenix is now. And they had a system of very sophisticated canals to grow crops. And there was a drought that came along during the medieval period, and it essentially forced them out of business. And they had to change their lifestyle, and their territory shrank considerably. Comes up a lot in Arizona when you talk about drought and what's going on now. But there's a lesson there. There's a lesson with the what were called the Anasazi, which are now called the ancient Puebloans, and with other peoples. When you walk to Mesa Verde and some of these other ancient sites, something that strikes you is just how what a thin margin there is for this region of survival, and if water isn't there, it changes the whole ball game.
Hmm. Well, we have an email from Elspeth in Richmond who says, "In our home, we save water in many ways." She lists a few things: no running water when brushing the teeth, drip irrigation system in the yard, shower head is a water saver, running the dishwasher and the washer only when there's a full load. What are your thoughts about these, Jim? I mean, a lot of people say that obviously we need major government policy changes. We're not going to see that from Washington, at least in the next couple years. We clearly need state and local officials to take action, but individual action is also important.
Well, the big thing that changed policy in Phoenix was the pricing of water. And when in the summer, especially when water is most in demand, they raise the price. And so that has driven, and this is probably the single biggest thing in terms of what someone can do, that has driven a tearing up, what they call, in some places where they pay you to do this, cash for grass. That you dig up your lawn and you replace it with a desert xeriscape landscape. So instead of, you know, Kentucky bluegrass that has to be watered all the time, you replace it with stones and cactus and other desert plants, which don't need to be watered, and that is huge. And in Phoenix, they didn't offer cash for grass that way, but they did price water to the point where people said, you know, I'm not going to pay $100 or $200 a month or whatever it is for water. I'm just going to go to something that's far less consumptive. So that's a big part of what cities are doing. And Las Vegas is doing that, and parts of California and elsewhere. That's really a key.
Jim, you also write that in 1922, Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, who created a Colorado River Compact that divvied up 15 million acre-feet of water, 7.5 million to the upper basin states and the same amount to the lower basin states, which includes California. This treaty was signed during one of the wettest periods. Has there been any changes to this law since 1922?
Well, there have been additions. There have been, that, by the way, was called the pluvial. It was a pluvial period. A pluvial period is when you have an unusual amount of rain, and I think it was from like 1905 to 1920 something, where it rained a lot. And it was also when a lot of the West was settled, so people thought, "Wow, this is going to be great." You know, farms did well, ranches did well, and then it all went away in the late 1920s. So it fooled everybody because it coincided with this period of frontier settlement. Has it been changed? It has been changed some, but the real change is being forced on the river because there simply isn't enough water. And the law of the river, as it's called, will always be there and always be part of the scene, but changes will be made without changing the law, but simply because it's being forced on them. And that's part what the drought contingency plan is about.
And how do they measure these amounts of water?
You mean how do they measure the amounts in the river?
Well, when they divvy it up, how do they measure it?
Well, there are gates, head gates, and there are ditch riders in places, people who ride along the river and in their truck and make sure no one's taking too much. There are places where there are stream gauges, and it's measured that way. So it's divvied up. I had that question myself, but the people say it's a pretty fair system.
Is there anything else? We have just a couple minutes left. In this five-part series, is there anything else that really stood out for you during this research as you traveled the full length of the river?
Yes, we didn't talk too much about the lower Colorado. I think that's probably perhaps the biggest sin, if there is such a thing, on the Colorado River, is what happened from the Mexican border. Well, there's lots of sins along the Colorado River, but down below the border in the Colorado River Delta was Aldo Leopold was there. He wrote about this in the 20s, and other people have written about it. It was this incredibly lush delta with hundreds of bird species and millions of birds, individual birds. It was a swamp. It was marshes. It was a river. It was forest. It had, you know, jaguars. It had other species. It was incredibly rich in biodiversity. And that's essentially gone now. The river is the river channel is still there, but the water is gone, and so all of the species that lived there left. And we flew over it. It's this incredibly huge, fertile. It was fertile, but it's an incredibly huge area that was a nursery for fish, a nursery for mammals, all these things. And now I have to say there's a glimmer of hope there in that, that this group called Raise the River, which is a coalition of environmental groups, have restored, I think it's 8 miles of the Colorado River there. The U.S. and Mexico have agreed to provide some water for this area, Laguna Grande it's called. They use water that runs off from some of the farm fields. But by and large, this 100-mile-long river delta is all but disappeared, and it's going to take a lot to bring it back if that ever happens.
Wow. In our remaining minutes, Jim, I wanted to ask you about two other huge pieces of news. Obviously, we can't go into in depth, but I just wanted to mention these and then get your thoughts. The Guardian recently had a piece called Unprecedented U.S. Flood Season Will Imperil 200 Million People. The severe flooding in the Midwest is set to only be a prelude to unprecedented levels of flooding across the U.S. in the coming months that will affect 200 million people. This is according to federal government scientists. What are your thoughts on this? Two-thirds of the lower 48 states will have a heightened risk of flooding until May, according to NOAA.
This is a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier. One is, I think the atmosphere holds more water because it's warmer, 7% more. And so we're going to see more of this kind of a thing. And then you have the you have this deforestation that's taken place all over the country. And we don't even think about it anymore because it's been so long. But forested areas prevent flooding. And trees soak up the rain. And when you take away trees and put in homes and roads and so on, a lot of the water that falls no longer soaks in. It runs off into the river, and it ends up flooding. That's happening all over the world, and that's something we don't talk a lot about. But here's the third part of this that I think very few people, I wrote a piece about this for the Times, and I think very few people talk about it, but it's something to think about. There are many people, scientists, who think that the deforestation of the Amazon is the size of the United States, and it's in the center of the South American continent, but that is a driver of global climate systems. And as it's being dismantled, and it is being cut down, deforested, and planted, and so on, it's changing the way the climate systems work in the world. And no one really knows how they work in any detail, but there is a link between the Amazon and rain in Texas, California, and so on. So it's something for more study, certainly, but it's also something to think about, the fact that this world is connected. And it's not just flooding in the Midwest to think about by itself, but to think about how these systems work and to try and, again, to honor these things that we don't know and stop behaving the way that we are before we destroy the place.
And we're definitely going to do a show about what's happening in Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. Headline from The Guardian, cyclone death toll passes 750 with more than 110,000 now in camps. I mean, it's just, Jim, the changes that we're seeing around the world, it's just, there's so much devastation.
This is because of flooding?
Right. No, this is the cyclone.
Oh, this
and major flooding. Cyclone hit areas. They're at risk of waterborne diseases. I mean, places are just underwater.
I remember trees, clean water. I wrote a book called The Man Who Planted Trees, and the fellow in it, David Millark, said to me, he didn't go to college. He's kind of a self-taught type, but he said, name a problem that isn't solved by planting more trees. And I think that's a challenge I would throw out to your listeners, is think about that. And let me know if you think of anything.
Jim Robbins is a veteran environmental journalist based in Helena, Montana. You can find his series at yourcallradio.org. Jim, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.